Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, hello, everyone. This is Carol Copeland-Thomas. Let me start this from the top. You know, technology sometimes can be pretty tricky, so here we go again. Today, we'll give highlights of the major Supreme Court rulings from DNA patenting to interpretations of the Voting Rights Act to the future of same-sex marriage in our country. Sweeping changes are expected because of their ruling, and the economic and social outcome of Americans have now been significantly influenced by this month's rulings. The nine justices are now on summer break, but they didn't depart without leaving their footprint on the country's social and economic infrastructure. We'll also give you specific ways to protect our youth during Student Safety Month, a month-long commemoration I created in tribute to the death of my son, the Carl D. Thomas Jr., some 16 years ago. Insightful, informational, and action-driven. That describes today's show topics. I am Carol Copeland-Thomas, and you're listening to Focus on Empowerment. Well, hello, this is Carol Copeland-Thomas, and sort of strange things are happening with technology, both with my phone and with the studio board, but you always do workarounds. I learned a long time ago that some things are just meant to be, and sometimes you think you have everything down pat, and you don't, but you just keep going anyway, and you find new ways to really create situations that otherwise would be a little tricky. We're going to move ahead, and we have a lot to talk about today, and particularly about the rulings, the three Supreme Court rulings that took place in the month of June, three of the rulings yesterday. There are actually four rulings altogether. And then also Student Safety Month and why that month was started about 1998 or so. Also, I'm really excited because we had a wonderful webinar earlier this week with Sima Lieberman. Sima Lieberman is a diversity professional out in California who is a lesbian and was in a very committed, loving relationship for 18 years before her partner died of a heart attack and all of the complications that came about as a result of her death, which literally tie in with the Supreme Court rulings that took place this week. We broadcast that webinar live. We had a wonderful, robust group of people who participated, and now you have an opportunity to listen to the archive. I understand how busy people are. We're all very busy. But as a member of the Multicultural Symposium Series, you have the opportunity to listen to that webinar, learn an awful lot of information so that you can become a lot more informed, and also the other webinars that we have in the members-only section of the web page that is devoted and dedicated to members of the Multicultural Symposium Series. You can go to www.mssconnect.com. That's www.mssconnect.com. And find out more about membership. It's only $99 a year. It includes all of the webinars that we have, as well as our upcoming November 9th conference, our multicultural conference that will be held at the University of Massachusetts Boston campus. Now, I'm especially excited about that conference because I've now confirmed both of my keynote speakers in the morning and also in the afternoon with our lunch special. In the morning, I'm going to have one of our top broadcasters here in the New England region, LaToya Edwards. She is a newswoman extraordinaire, journalist, and also the anchor of NECN, New England Cable Network. And she's really a good speaker, is so informed, and really a trailblazer when it comes to journalism as a woman of color. So she will be our headline speaker in the morning, guaranteed to really get your spirits lifted and fortify you. And then in the afternoon, I have a very seasoned, wonderful speaker, Vice President of Global Diversity at State Street Financial Services, State Street Corporation, a very large multinational bank, Paul Francisco, a wonderful friend, supporter. State Street is actually sponsoring our multicultural conference, and he will be our keynote speaker at lunch. So we have just great speakers and many more to come that we'll be announcing between now and November. We'll have information starting in July about the conference series, but this is an opportunity for you to put it on your calendar. That's Thursday, November 7th, and to actually come and participate in this wonderful interactive one-day conference that I'm very pleased to put on. This is the seventh conference that I will have held, and it's definitely positively going to be the best. So in the coming weeks, we'll tell you more information about that. We're continuing to improve our website. Our magazine, Connections Magazine, will come out this summer as well. So lots of great things all related to multiculturalism. Now, let's jump right into what's going on with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is now on its summer break, and typically what they do every year with the cases that they have accepted to hear, they typically will wait and give the ruling on the important cases or the big cases at the end of their tenure for that particular year. So just like kids go to school and they get out for a summer break in June, well, that's what the Supreme Court is doing, even though they are definitely not kids. But they're now on vacation, and they wait for the ruling, and the rest is history. And typically the news media reacts to it, and it has lots of implications. So one of them has to do with DNA patenting, and who owns the samples of DNA that are being used for research. The other deals with voting rights, and the other deals with same-sex marriage. So I'm going to go down the rule. I said there were three, but there are actually four rulings. Two of them are related. The first one was ruled on June 13th, and this is the Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. These are two companies, and one person who was involved in determining, or at least one person implicated and involved, or one company implicated and involved in who owns the DNA for in terms of patenting. And the court ruled, I'm going to read this. This is from Wikipedia, and I'll try to interpret it because I heard an interview about this. The court held in favor of petitioners that naturally occurring sequences of DNA cannot be patented. However, artificially created DNA is patent eligible. So this is it. If a company is using someone's cells and from that they extract DNA, and obviously DNA testing is used now to prove the parents in paternity cases, the paternity disputes, they will typically get the DNA, they'll probably, you know, draw blood or whatever, and they will determine the DNA of a person. So what they're saying now is that a company cannot patent the actual DNA of a person. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm trying to interpret this correctly, and if you are a lawyer, and I've not said this correct, please send me an email so I can correct it next week. And you can send it to Tell Carol, TellCarole, at mac.com. I would be happy to recreate or correct my mistake. But the way I interpret this is that the Supreme Court did not want to have one company to have total control over somebody's DNA. Why? Because it creates a monopoly, an artificial monopoly, that can be very harmful in terms of research and development. And so often, research and development relies on the testings, the findings, the mistakes, the discoveries of other companies. They share information back and forth. That is just the history of how R&D is done. So this one company, in this case, the Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics, one company wanted to own that DNA so that they would have total control going forward, which was in contrast to what typically is done in the case of DNA sharing and research sharing. So very quickly, let me just read this so that we'll all be clear on this. It says, the Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics was a case challenging the validity of gene patents in the United States, specifically challenging certain claims in issued patents owned or controlled by Myriad Genetics that cover isolated DNA sequences, methods to diagnose propensity to cancer by looking for mutated DNA sequences, and methods to identify drugs using isolated DNA sequences. Since prior to this case, the U.S. Patent Office accepted patents on isolated DNA sequences as a composition of matter. Diagnosed claims were already under question through the Henry Belisky versus Mayo, this is another case. Drug screening claims were not seriously questioned prior to this case. And there's more information about this. I would just really suggest you go either to the Supreme Court website, which I believe probably is supremecourt.org. You can go to Wikipedia, where I am, and it'll give you more information about this. But the way I understand this, and let me just see if I can read a little bit more, and this is important to understand because the whole thing says who controls and who owns DNA, particularly in the research world. Because proponents of the validity of these patents argued that they encouraged investment in biotechnology and promote innovation in genetic research by not keeping technology shrouded in secrecy. Opponents argued that these patents stifled innovation by preventing others from conducting cancer research, limit options on cancer patients in seeking genetic testing, and are not valid because they claim genetic information that is not inventive, but is rather produced by nature. So it's nature versus manufactured DNA. So, again, what I'm hearing is, I probably need to read a little bit more so we're clear on this. The case was originally heard in Southern District Court in New York. The plaintiffs appealed to the Supreme Court, which granted and remanded the case to Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit circuit did not change its opinion. So on September 25th, 2012, the American ACLU and Public Patent Foundation filed a petition with the Supreme Court with respect to the second Federal Circuit decision. And on June 13th, 2013, in a unanimous decision, which is unusual for the Supreme Court invalidated Myriad's claims to isolated genes. So Myriad wanted to own the DNA genes in this case. The court held that merely isolating genes that are found in nature does not make them worthy of having a patent. It's important so that, again, I can see one company trying to corner the market on that. And in this case, the Supreme Court said no. So that was the Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics that wanted to control this isolated gene series. And the court said, no, you can't do that. You can't take something from nature and put a patent on it. That was that case. I think I did pretty well on interpreting that one. Okay, second of four cases is Fisher versus the University of Texas. The Fifth Circuit failed to apply strict scrutiny when it affirmed the University of Texas affirmative action policy. The decision is vacated and the case is remanded for further consideration. So let me click on that and give you more information about this case. The United States District Court heard Fisher versus the University of Texas in 2009 and upheld the legality of the university's admissions policy in a summary judgment. The case was appealed in the Fifth Circuit, which which also ruled in the university's favor. On June 24th, the Fifth Circuit was vacated and remanded in a 7-1 decision with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg dissenting. Justice Antonio Scalia and Clarence Thomas filed concurrent opinions. Now, that's not really the case that I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk more about the voting rights case. So I'm going to go to statement that has been written by the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and this is actually an official statement about what the Supreme Court ruled 2 days ago on voting rights, and this will give you more information about the concern many of us have about sort of taking out the guts of the Voting Rights Act. This was a couple of days ago, the U.S. Supreme Court has cast a shadow over the landscape that has been carefully groomed to protect the voting rights of every American and monitor any efforts to disenfranchise voters. The deeply divided bench voted 5-4 to strike down Section 4. The bare majority ruled that section was outdated and based on progress made over the years, a new formula needs to be determined, which cities and states must get permission from the federal government before changing their voting procedures. And the AME Church is very concerned. They have a whole statement here where they're very concerned about this ruling by the Supreme Court because it really weakens the Voting Rights Act. So let me just, I think I can interpret this one pretty well. What the court was saying, that when the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965, that was some 40 years ago, 40 plus years ago, we were in a different era. And there was necessity to have the federal government enforce voting rights, particularly for black people. During that time, you had poll taxes, and you had many places, particularly in the South, where black people could not vote. And so during that time, the Voting Rights Act was put in place to protect black people, so giving them the right to vote in some cases for the first time. Selma, Alabama, the March on Selma, 1965, Bloody Sunday, John Lewis, all those awful scenes were the buildup to what became the Voting Rights Act. The court is saying now, 40-plus years later, we don't need that kind of enforcement, and better still, Congress needs to go and do some more work to update the Voting Rights Act. Well, if you have looked at all at what has happened with the last two elections, the last two presidential elections in 2008 and 2012, and the midterm elections, you will see a whole list of new voting restrictions from New Hampshire to Rhode Island to Texas to several states in the South to deliberately restrict the voting rights or make it more stringent for people to vote. Now, a lot of civil rights groups, and I am in agreement with this, feel that the ruling of the Supreme Court that deals with voting rights totally ignored the current list of activities that are in place to restrict people from voting. And they were strictly looking at what happened 40 years ago and what is going on now in terms of racial equality issues. Now, yes, we do have a black president. That's wonderful. Yes, we do have many people of color in Congress and in state legislatures. Yes, we have that. We know where people can live. We understand all that, and certainly everybody has the right to vote, and poll taxes were repealed in the 60s. We have that. But with the new right-wing conservative activities, the Tea Party in particular, and what is now being done during midterm elections, it makes it more important than ever to ensure that there are laws in place to guarantee people the right to vote and guarantee them an unencumbered way to vote in all elections. So they don't have to worry about bringing birth certificates or double birth certificates or recite the Constitution front and back and give me not only all the 66 books of the Bible, but I want you to recite every single verse. Now, that kind of stupid stuff was done with poll taxes. And there is a resurgence in that kind of restriction that is directly related to the fact that, according to the statistics that we've seen in the 2012 elections, you had a large number of black people who voted in the 2012 elections. More blacks in proportion with their percentage voted than whites for the first time ever in the history of the United States. Therefore, you have all these conservative groups, very right-wing conservative groups, that have all of these voter restriction laws that were not taken into consideration with the Supreme Court ruling. And so you do have civil rights groups, churches like the African Methodist Episcopal Church and others that are saying that this is unfair, and you've got to really look at what's taking place in these states. The A&E Church has said eliminating Section 4 and keeping Section 5 essentially guts a major provision and protection for those who have been subjected to historic and long-standing discrimination, including threats to life and livelihood. In those 15 states that are now being monitored, these are states that have these laws that apply to restrict voters, and others where new disenfranchising laws are being crafted, the AME Church will increase its efforts to register, mobilize, and educate potential voters. And it goes on and on. There are measures taking place in Florida and other parts of the country that are very actively trying to restrict and end Sunday voting. Sunday voting has been put in place in certain states because they want to make it convenient for people to vote. But, you know, when you want to control the country, then you restrict how many people can vote, and that's just the game that's being played. So that's the ruling that I wanted to talk with you about in terms of what was ruled on, this is Thursday, on Tuesday with the Supreme Court. Now, the other two rulings have to do with same-sex marriage, and very quickly, one was done, this is the United States versus Windsor, and Windsor relates to an elderly woman now who had to pay some, gosh, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of estate taxes because when her partner died, her marriage was not recognized in the state of California. And so she is extremely happy that now DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which was actually put in effect in 1996, has been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Section 3 of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, is unconstitutional as it violates due process and equal protection. Translation, anybody who would, and let me read the other ruling too. This is Hollingsworth versus Perry. The court held that the petitioners did not have standing in the matter under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. The decision of the district court is vacated, and the case is remanded to the Ninth Court Circuit under instructions that the appeal to be dismissed. So anybody in California who is in a same-sex relationship, they were trying to nullify all those relationships. So now, no, that's just been tossed out. So they are officially married. They're going to get remarried, and Governor Jerry Brown is now ordering across the state of California that they resume same-sex marriages. So these are interrelated. Translation, we are definitely on our way to normalizing same-sex marriage. The mere fact that DOMA was thrown out by the Supreme Court that unfortunately didn't do the right thing, I think, with the Voting Rights Act, they did the right thing with the Same-Sex Marriage Act. So if you live in California, if you live in Massachusetts, or any state that has officially recognized same-sex marriage, you not only get state benefits, you get federal benefits. The next step will be to just legalize same-sex marriage all over the country. The court didn't do that. They came very close to it by these two measures, but that'll be the next step. So, again, anyone who is in a same-sex marriage in a state where same-sex marriage is recognized will have benefit of not only state benefits, and we're talking about with their partner and spousal relationships, but also they will have an opportunity to have federal benefits, and there are hundreds of federal benefits that impact them. I suggest you listen to the webinar, join as a member of the Multicultural Symposium Series, and you can hear Sima Lieberman's story. You will understand why this is so important. You can listen to the archive. That archive is going to be put on the website in the next week, and then you'll have a chance to really understand for yourself why this is really an important measure. So that is the Supreme Court. Those are the Supreme Court rulings that just are, they're very transformational in terms of what's going to take place going forward, certainly in the case of same-sex marriage. Now, 16 years ago when my son passed away, I could have cried and crawled in a hole and just gone and died with him. But I chose not to do that. I had to, in many cases, rely on that faith that had been given to me and practice the faith that had been given to me in a very real and personal way. So I began speaking out on the importance of being safe as a young person, and I did that because my son was at a birthday party of a treasured friend. He was 17 years old. He hadn't had his license 2 months, and he started drinking at the party. Now, most of the people at the party were over 21. So they could legally have alcohol. He was younger. He started drinking. I didn't realize, he did recreational activities like this, like many young people. But the tragedy is that he got into an automobile and went on a joyride and hit a retaining wall and died within 5 minutes of that horrific experience. I and my family members have lived with this for now more than a decade plus. And as a result of that historic and horrific experience, I chose to actively help to keep young people safe. Thus, we have Student Safety Month, which I started in 1998. It provides activities, statistical information in the form of an 8-page document that you can download at www.tellcarole.com, TellCarole.com. You can go to that website and download that document and find out ways where you can keep your young people safe, where you can have real, honest conversations about drinking and driving and being safe. All of that kind of information from a very transparent perspective is what I poured into Student Safety Month, which now has been practiced for all these years. So I would encourage you to go to to tellcarole.com, TellCarole.com. You can go click right through to the Student Safety Month and download that, and most importantly, share it with the young people, with the one young person. Share it with adults. Share it with community groups and groups of young people to keep them safe. That is the whole purpose of Student Safety Month. We've had a whirlwind day, and I hope that you will have a great weekend. Study all this, and we'll be back next week with more information. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Take care.